The session we're having today is Hope in a Technological Age. Now, the word hope is kind of an interesting one in a technological society. And one of the concepts of the word hope is really a reliance upon technology. And you hear this all the time. It's built into our very way of talking. We say, for example, oh yes, there's an energy crisis. We identify a particular kind of problem, and then we say, oh yes, but there'll be photoelectric cells on the roofs of the buildings. There'll be nuclear fusion. We'll be able to solve that problem. We have great confidence in being able to solve problems. And you hear that kind of hope quite often. I think our discussion outside that, we were talking about that kind of hope, that you can go on out and solve problems. Okay, so this is kind of a hope that comes out of the technological age. And you hear this quite often. Economists make this assumption essentially all the time. They assume a continually growing economy, and you say, oh yes, but what about the resources? What about the environmental protection? And what about that? And they will turn around and say, yes, but look at all the progress we've made, and we'll be able to go ahead and solve these problems, and we'll be able to substitute one resource for another and develop new resources. And so it turns out that quite often the economists, the majority of economists that I've met and talked with, don't even think about limits because technology can solve the problems. Okay? So that's a kind of hope, small h, that we have in our society. I think in the last election, presidential election, you saw this on both sides. How many people were talking that the important thing was to get America going again and productivity? Okay? So you see, that was the message. That was we can produce, we can be productive, get the American system going again, which is really getting technology going again, although they may have called it the free enterprise system or whatever. It's really a technological way we can get more machines, we can be more productive, more efficient, we can do all these things, and then we'll be able to solve our problems. Okay? And therefore there's hope. Okay? That's kind of what happens. Okay? Does that fit your experience in terms of what you've heard people say? Okay. For the people listening to the tape, they're nodding yes. Okay? Okay. Well, I'd like to dig into this a little bit more. I'd like to dig into this. And I'm going to do this by relating to you some of my experiences. Okay? I teach. And I teach in the environmental area, and I teach also in the basic engineering courses. And some strange things happen to me in teaching. I start teaching some of our sharpest students, the sharpest ones. And we start talking about environmental problems, resource problems, and they're really bright students. And I find that these students start becoming cynical. They start becoming cynical or depressed or despair, and they're really fine people. They're not that kind of people, you know, by nature. What can we do? Gee, look at all these problems. They start becoming very cynical. Now, these are the sharpest students. Now, if technological hope, being able to solve all these problems, if this is the hope we're based upon, then you would think that the new generation of engineers coming out, the sharpest ones, the ones with the best grades and so forth, that they would be the ones to be most hopeful because they understand more than anyone else about how to solve these problems. But they're the ones that run the risk of being more cynical, losing hope, The ones who just kind of go in and at the undergraduate level just kind of grind out their work, okay? And they don't really ask a lot of these broader questions. Oh, they've got hope. Or the ones that don't know anything about technology, they've got hope. They've really got a tremendous amount. You have all kinds of politicians who don't know the least thing about it. They've got tremendous confidence in our ability. But what's going on here? Where the ones that I've met who are the sharpest, they have to struggle with cynicism. Something going on here. Okay? And we could, of course, just dismiss that. We could say, well, you don't have any nice, precise numbers on that. You don't have any kind of data on that. And you're just responding to people's feelings and not being objective. But there's a message in there that if I treat my experience honestly, there's a message in there. Okay? You agree with that? Something is a paradox in there. And I think that what we need to do in life is when we sense those a paradox like that, we've got to dig deeper into it because there's something important there. Something important there. And I would say that certainly this is affirmed in the Bible because the Bible is full of paradoxes and people who are caught in this. Jonah this morning, those of you who went to hear Jonah, I mean, there's a beautiful story where the paradox that that poor guy had to face. I mean, he tried to go ahead and deny being a prophet and try to run away. He got spit back on the land by a fish, and then he goes to preach damnation to Nineveh, and Nineveh repents, and he says, what have I done? You know, wait a minute, aren't you going to wipe them out? Here I've been here for 40 days telling them they're going to get bombed out, and now you're going to let them get away with all this. And then God says, well, they repented, and he says, yeah, but I told them they could, you know, they're going to get wiped out. Tremendous paradoxes, you know, tremendous paradoxes. Well, they're there in our real life, and what I suggest to you is we don't pursue those very often. We tend to dismiss these paradoxes, or we tend to treat them as our problem. You get a little anxiety over something, and then what you have to do is that's kind of a form of mild mental illness. It's your problem. It's internal, so maybe you take a pill or you go ahead and join some therapy group to cure that problem. Maybe it's a message. Well, what did I do when I found the student's cynicism? Well, I started telling him, hey, there's a lot we can do. Yeah, trying to build up their confidence that, yeah, they could solve some of these problems. And you've probably met people like this. You know, how to build, yes, you can do it. You can get out there. We can do it. And giving them a real, you know, a good pep talk and kind of giving them some examples of things that we can do. Yeah, we can solve these problems. We can solve these problems. Well, these are sharp students. I was losing the argument. That is difficult for a professor to admit. Again, I had to be sensitive to my gut. That as I was saying, yes, there are these solutions to these problems. And the students would say, yeah, but wait a minute, you do that, it's not going to make a bit of difference. And then they would quote different things to me. In the environmental area, they'd say, hey, wait a minute, look what's happened here at Oregon State University. He says, you're getting rid of essentially the environmental program. He says, that's not contributing to productivity. And you're telling me we're going to be able to solve all the problems? So you can't even solve the problems here at OSU. And they begin to say things like that. Now, of course, we professors have ways of protecting ourselves from those. That would usually be called disrespectful. You say, it's honest. And I found what I was doing is I was starting to pull rank on them. I like to consider myself a little open in terms of people giving criticism to me, and so I didn't just tell them to shut up. I mean, there are more subtle ways of pulling rank. You start drawing a lot of things on the blackboard, you start talking a little bit louder and start really giving, and they get the message.
mean, these students have been in education for a long time. They get the message and they keep quiet. But their silence speaks if you will really listen to it. Again, it doesn't make much sense. Silence speaking? Sounds like something out of the Bible.
Okay, not an engineering class.
Well, I found this very distressing. And I began to think a little bit more about the experience that students met in the engineering experience, the educational experience, all the way from when they were freshmen. Typically what happens, how many people are engineers or have been in an engineering? No? Okay. They usually don't come to sessions like this, unfortunately. But they represent, our engineering education probably represents more the character of our times than a study of the Bible. I'm convinced of that. Okay. And that's a problem, particularly for engineers who are also Christian. It's a problem. Well, if you go back on the education, we begin to learn something about what technology really is and what a technological age really is. That's one thing. We tend to think of a technological age as being one of machines and big organizations. No. That's one of the characteristics of a technological age. It's not the fundamental one. If we go back to the engineering education, we begin to find out what is really fundamental to our technological age. Now, if you go into there and go into a classroom, say, engineering mechanics, a sophomore year, a course called statics, what do we do there in engineering mechanics? Do they bring in monkey wrenches and screwdrivers and work on machines? No, they don't. They bring in pencil and paper, and they work problems. They solve problems over and over again. When I teach statics, there's about 160 students, okay? Each one does about 100 problems. That means I have to keep track of 16,000 problems in 10 weeks. Okay? 16,000. Now, I don't grade them all. We hire two graders, but you end up being a manager. Just keeping track of that many numbers is mind-boggling. But anyhow, the students have all these problems to work, and they have to work them precisely. They have to identify the questions exactly. They have to break them down into parts, the proper parts. They have to be efficient and productive in the way they do things. And if they don't do that, they fail. They fail. And notice the subtle psychology there. Okay? If you don't do these things, you fail. Nothing indirect about that, you know. Right there, if you're not an efficient problem solver, you break them down into parts and you're precise, you fail. Period. That's it. It doesn't even matter whether you know how to work on machines. It doesn't matter whether, you know, you're an interesting person. If you can't objectively solve those problems in an efficient manner and precise manner and break them down to parts properly, you fail. Period. That's it. That's the message. That's the message of the technological age. That's what technology is. Solving problems efficiently, in a productive way, objectively, precise, breaking them down into parts and evaluating performance. All of those kinds of things. Those attitudes that we take for granted. Those are added the characteristics of a technological age. Okay, control, order, efficiency, productivity, objectivity, precision, solving problems efficiently. All of those things are the characteristics of our technological age. Break them down into workable parts. Okay, all of that. And you and I are as much a part of that as the engineers are. I think wrong? Well, I see most of you have these little devices strapped to your bodies. What are they? a watch, a clock. You have them peering over the rooms that you work in, by your bedsides. What do they do? What do they do? We say they measure time. Ha ha! Measure time. What's time? Have you ever thought about that? We're going to have a session later on time. It's called Christmas time and Christmas time. Two different concepts of time. And what we'll find out there, and I'll just give you a hint on what we'll find out there, is that they are not measuring something from nature. They are regulating your behavior, devices to regulate your behavior so you can be in a nice, orderly way, you can interact with people, so you can control your lives more precisely, so you can solve problems more efficiently, so you can do the very things that I made the students do in engineering mechanics. Okay? And you call it natural. Oh, a clock measures time. Time's something given to us by nature. Do you know most cultures didn't have the concept of time that we have? Some didn't even have a word for time. And when they look at how we behave with respect to time, oh, they're lazy. And we take it as natural because we have accepted as basis of what it means to be human, solve problems, be efficient, so forth and so on. Now, I'm not saying that those attitudes are wrong. I am not saying that they are wrong. These attitudes that lie at the base of technology. I'm not saying that efficiency is wrong. I'm not saying that at all. Or solving problems is wrong. I'm not saying that. And you see, part of our technological way of thinking is trying to describe something as either right or wrong. What I'd say to you is, reflecting back, I'd see if I can go maybe to some religious terms and see if we can talk about this technology a little bit. Technology may be demonic. Now that sounds weird. Okay. Demonic brings to image these demons with pitchforks and, you know, horns and so forth. But that's not a very good description of demonic. What is demonic? Demonic is this. Demonic is always associated with the good. Always. That's strange. And it's a vehicle to goodness, to the good. Now, certainly technology, that is efficient problem solving, that can be a vehicle to goodness. You bring in someone to the hospital and they're efficient, they can solve the problem of what's there. That's certainly good. But where it becomes demonic is where the vehicle to goodness becomes so overextended that it becomes the good. The good. So instead of saying, well, efficiency is good in order to take care of these people because we care for these people, instead, efficiency becomes goodness in itself. And how many politicians did you hear say, we have to be productive, period. Okay. Productivity became goodness in itself. Efficiency became goodness in itself. Problem solving became goodness in itself. Objectivity becomes goodness in itself. They say, be objective, don't be so emotional. You're supposed to do that. You get the picture now? That somehow a vehicle for goodness takes over. And that's what's happening in a technological age. Okay? Now, what does this have to do with my cynical students? Well, we got back there and we began to look at the problems. I'll come back to the demonic, so just keep that in your mind. Okay? And we began to find that no matter what kinds of solutions we propose, they fit into two categories. One, the solution was so big that no one would be able to carry it out. Or if we came up with a solution that you could carry out, it was trivial compared to the problems. You see, you get the... You can begin to understand why they were becoming feeling cynical. They were losing hope. Does everybody get that feeling? And they were bright students. You see, the students who aren't the sharpest and ask questions, what they do is they narrow, if they can't get a solution, they narrow down the problem until they can get a solution. I have a colleague that says, "Them's that got the answers don't know the questions." Okay. And that seems to be a lot of truth. But these students were sharp, and they weren't willing to narrow down the problems in order to fit the solutions. And I think, I hope you would like to have some engineers who would do that. Okay, but then they became cynical. And I tried to go ahead and turn around and tell them, yes, you can solve these problems. You can do this. And I put data up, objective, precise data, and so forth and so on. And I began to realize, as I've told you, that I was pulling rank on them. And they were losing hope. And I said to myself, is that what I'm doing in this course? Making cynics? Destroying hope? I found out later. Yes.
I was doing it.
I said, huh, wait a minute. What's wrong? That's not right. Well, let's start to think about that a little bit. Let's think about it from our biblical tradition. That's not the way I thought of it back then. I can think of it in biblical tradition here because I'm in a community that's like that, but on the outside world, that's pretty hard to think that way. Okay? Is that the basis of hope in Christianity? To be able to solve the problems efficiently and effectively? Is that the basis of hope? Is that what hope is about? Is it? Is that how we should base our hope? Think about it. That we will be able to solve the problems. We'll be able to control it and use the resources right and control it and be able to get solutions to any of these problems. Is that the basis of hope? Huh? I see a few heads nodding. What do you say? Say it. What do you think? Is that the basis of hope?
No.
No, it's not. It's not the basis of hope. Certainly for Lutherans, we have grace, the concept of grace. And grace, you know, hope, I think hope is related to the word grace. You know, where does that come from? From solving problems? How does it come? It's a gift. It's a gift. Now, isn't that absurd? Is it? Yes, in a technological age, it is absurd, right? And I guess in the biblical time, it was absurd too, wasn't it? Wasn't it, Paul? What did Paul have to say about scandal to the Greeks?
Foolishness
and scandal. Foolishness and scandal. How absurd.
I was going to say that, but the shift is not that we are going to solve the problems, is that the technological question is, what would happen if we asked, is God going to solve the problems?
Right, but
would that shift it at all or not?
Well, I think we have to watch out there too.
Yeah.
Because then we would be kind of thinking of God as being the great technologist in the sky.
Yeah.
And we would be inframing God. And I think those of you who went to Larry Rasmussen's course or session last time, we would be domesticating God. We would be saying God must be a technologist if he's going to give us hope. And as God says, I am who I am, not who you make me to be. Okay? And we should be thankful that that's true. Because if God is who we make God to be, even the language, I say he, and we tend to make God a male, but we need language, but we always better recognize the limitations of it. If God is merely who we make God to be, then he is simply a figment of our imagination. And we are caught in nothingness except for the own kind of little things that we can stick in our own heads and we gather together to shout to each other, yes, it's true, because we're scared that it might not be. So we ought to be thankful that God says, I am who I am, so that we're not lost, trapped in our own perceptions. Okay? So, we find from the Bible then, that solving problems is not the basis of hope. Hope is a gift, an absurd gift. Okay? An absurd gift. And people should, are called, here's another word, through grace, to act. Are they called to act because they can get solutions to problems? Is that why they are called? No. They're called through grace, which is a gift. And I think last night's sermon, you know, it's going to call, certainly after last night's sermon, we can't say, oh, yes, and God calls me, and then I'll act, and then there won't be any problems. Ah, that whole message last night disrupted that whole thing. I think he quotes Jesus as saying, yes, and children will be divided against their, with their parents. Okay? Wow, talk about a problem. So the idea that we are called and if we respond to that call, we'll have all the solutions, or God will give us the solutions, and that's why we can hope. What that is a way of shoving the concept of grace into the limitations of technology. You see, what we're doing is we're responding the same way the students in my class did. I gave them a problem, and if they couldn't work it efficiently, precisely, and so forth and so on, they failed. And we're tending to see life that way. See? If we don't have all the solutions and we can't come up with them, and then we fail. And if God can't go ahead and come up with the solutions of all of these things in a nice, precise, and orderly manner, then God fails. Okay? That's what we're really saying. You get the picture. What we're doing is we're taking what is part of our technological age and we're shoving hope into it. So those students, when they were losing hope, when I kept trying to shove solutions down their throat, there's something going on there. I ought to listen to them, right? They're saying they're bright and they can see that and they can feel it. But somehow, that's not where hope, what hope is about. At least hope with a capital H. I'm not saying let's forget about solving problems. But when we really press ourselves, hope can't come from there. These students are bright. They know, they looked around at the problems. And they were struggling to come up with solutions, even hypothetical solutions, never mind even ones that they could do. And they could not. So what do I say to them? Here we could, of course, pick up a Bible and we could read, you know, a number of stories, a number of Bible verses. But that doesn't work so well on the outside. That doesn't work so well. I'm not so sure it works as well in here as we would like to think it does. I'm not so sure we just kind of insulate ourselves from all the problems. We go, yeah. And we really don't, you know, we live in two different worlds and we can solve all the problems in Koinonia right here. And then we go in the outside world and we're confronted with the same problems and the lack of hope. But do I really need the Bible, essentially? Is that the only way I can communicate to them? That's an interesting question.
It's a good one, though.
Yeah. Do you just need the Bible? Is that the only way? Seems to me, if that's the way we think, that concept of the demonic may come with regard to the Bible. Is that the only way God can speak? Is through the Bible? The only way? I am who I am, God says. Does that mean that God is constrained to only speak through the Bible? I don't think so. And I don't think that's part of Lutheran tradition. I'm not very up on that, but what do you have to say?
Oh, Luther was dead. Yeah, he really blew the whistle on that kind of thing. You know, he was the one who really tried to get people to focus on the Bible, but he kept calling it the cradle in terms of Christmas. He called it the manger that held the baby. The vehicle. Use the words that you talked about before. The vehicle.
Yeah.
And force people into thinking it in terms of a vehicle rather than an object.
Yeah, and if we worship the manger, what happens to us? Well, and that's idolatry, really, or the demonic. See, it's rather than being a vehicle to goodness, capital G, okay? To good, the good, God, take out one O, put, okay? Then it becomes demonic then, and we start looking, and if you went to one of our other sessions, we look at the Bible like this big computer program, okay? I mean, there's a real technological way of looking at the Bible. So then, somehow there's a message that can come through, but we're just not used to it, you know. We tend to think of God's call of these lightning bolts and like Moses had it, rather than in really looking and pursuing the paradoxes of our own lives. Well, here's what happened in my class. How am I going to provide these people with an answer on this hope? And an answer that hope is a gift. An absurd gift. And that's the joy of an absurd gift. When we look at those banners over in the hall behind us there, you see one of the banners has joy. Joy? Here. How does that answer to cynicism? How do you switch to get them to realize that hope is a gift with joy? Rather than the cynicism. What do you say to them? Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that seemed to work, that happened, the gift, not from me. I didn't know what to do. I didn't. I guess what I did do, though, I listened to them and I listened to my gut. It took me a little while. I mean, we were in a paradox. I could feel a cynicism. I could feel it. I could feel a lack of hope. So finally, in frustration, I said, well, can you do something? And he said, well, of course. And I said, well, yeah, of course we can do something. We'll do our homework, and if we're wrong, we'll say so. Okay? I said, but you can do something. They said, yeah, but it won't. And I said, wait. Can you do something? I said, yeah, we can do something. Then I said to him, all right, now say to yourself, but it won't make a bit of difference. Because they said that. And say to yourself, I might even be wrong. And then say to yourself, I'll probably get in trouble for doing it. Now, it's been maybe a year or two later, after hearing a whole lot of sermons, sort of, that I began to realize that maybe there was, for me at least, the theological message in there. Okay? But it won't make a bit of difference. In other words, don't worry, you know, sure, you're not going to have a solution. You may be wrong. I mean, certainly we don't need grace if we're always going to be right. You're going to probably get in trouble. Certainly the Bible's full of that. And then in the end, the answer is an absurd smile. Now I would say that, although somewhat crude, comes closer to what the Bible says about hope than all the other things that I was struggling before about, trying to convince them and give them pep talks about how they could go out and get solutions to problems and be productive people and efficient people and the rest of it. And I found that they could accept that answer. I didn't have anybody come up after that and say, yes, but what about, they accepted the smile as the answer. Now, I think that tells us about hope then in a technological age. Hope is a gift. An absurd gift. And a gift associated with joy, an absurd joy, an irrational joy, if you want to call it that, an impractical joy, yeah, get you in trouble joy, yeah. It is that, expressed in a smile. It doesn't fit the technological age that we're in. It's a gift, but we've got to remember God says, I am who I am. If he wants to give that gift, he can. And I think we can be thankful for it. Okay. That's all I have to say right now. It's just sharing with you that story. And I'd like to get some of your responses back.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why do students come to your classes to learn to solve problems?
Well, one of the reasons, they want to get jobs. Another reason is that's a vehicle to do something good. Okay, remember we said in the demonic, it's a vehicle to do something good. They really want to. Many of them are really concerned about the problems out there. And that's good. But the demonic part came in saying, yes, we live in a technological age, we want to solve problems, we want to do that. The demonic part said, therefore, hope must be based upon solving problems and the rest of it. That was the demonic side, is where goodness itself had to fit into the technological way of doing things. They wanted to do some good things. They really do. Particularly, you know, the ones that ask these kinds of questions. The ones that don't ask the questions, they want a job. They don't want to worry about these kinds of things. So they're really concerned. They're really dedicated in that sense. There's some idealism.
How do they generally feel about nuclear problems in the world?
Just overwhelmed. How can we possibly? They have the same kinds of frustrations when we were in here talking about nonviolence. They look at that and they become very distressed. Sometimes they become angry, justifiably so, at the educational system where we have a huge percentage of our technically trained people going into military and we have essentially no courses on how do conflicts even arise. You know, on really studying, you know, what do we mean by nuclear deterrence? And we just don't do any of that outside of the ROTC, outside of the people being trained in for the military. And there's some good people in there. They will come out work with it. You say we don't do that because that's impractical, that's all those kinds of things. There's a whole range of problems that we don't address, and they don't like that. So they are very much concerned about the nuclear, and there are some of them who, I had one come back and he said, I won't work on anything in that area. And right now, there are tremendous job opportunities associated with military. And the ones in terms of environment are essentially dried up. They just really, you know, just really aren't there. So sometimes it's a tough choice for them. They don't have the answers, and they're going to go ahead and struggle in it. They're going to be confused. They won't get the answers to the problems. But I guess maybe what they got out of the smile is they still can hope.
Hope springs eternal.
Yeah, right, and it's a gift. And it's a gift we really need, and it's a gift that the person who really asks questions, they're the person who faces the despair, is the one who gets that hope. You see, those students face the despair. Those who just get their hope because they don't understand the problems, and they assume someone else can solve them, or, oh, don't talk about that, I don't want to be depressed about that, that's a downer. They're not going to see the hope with a capital H. That's why Holden is a very hopeful place, is because you can ask any question you want, and any topic that comes up is legitimate. And most of the sessions, we don't come up with solutions. We do come up with hope, though. Yes?
Well, I'm struck by what you were saying in the sense of despair comes from approaching a problem and anticipating you're going to solve it or know the answer based on some previous knowledge that you have, where the hope is approaching that problem with the unknowns and maybe creating a new solution that previously has not.
But your hope,
available.
Right, you may create a new, you may, I emphasize
right.
May.
Right.
The hope comes to you regardless of whether you come up with a solution
right.
or not.
And that leaves an opening for right. a creative solution instead
right.
of the predictable way of solving
exactly.
problems.
Exactly.
And
right.
that's exciting if you think about it that way.
It is exciting.
It's very anxiety producing.
Exactly. It
yeah.
is very anxiety producing. And there we have to kind of think about what anxiety is.
And we talk about different people, like the prophets being called by God. Well, isn't anxiety a call? When you feel anxious, how do you feel? You feel, you know, there's something wrong going on, and but it's not just that. You feel like, I want to do something, but I don't know what to do, right? That's a call, okay? It's a call to be beyond all the standard ways of doing things. And so you're upset, you're not sure, but you feel like you need to, you're impelled to do something more. And in a technological society, that is treated as a problem to be solved, anxiety. And we have lots of solutions, and the widest, I am told, the drug that's prescribed most has to do with anxiety as a way of suppressing it. Now, I think in some cases people may need that. That may be true. But I think if we assume that anxiety is a form of illness, then we're in trouble. But, of course, it will be a form of illness if we can't accept hope as a gift. If you see, if you have that anxiety and you can't accept hope as a gift, well, you just wallow in the despair. Now, if you don't approach the despair, then, of course, you'll be satisfied with the cheap hope. Well, someone's going to solve this problem. I don't know who. Technology's going to solve the problem. I'll tell you that if you rely on that, you're on very thin ice, non-ice. By entering the despair and struggling in it, the hope comes as a gift. So we can't think of despair as the opposite of hope. We cannot. People think of, you know, there's hope over here, despair over here, and of course what you want to try and do is get from here over to here, and one way of getting towards more hope is getting away from despair. And one way to get away from despair is just don't ask all these big questions.
Isn't that kind of what has been happening in the country lately, rather than, it seems as if the country's swing is more for let's really get into the technology, and let's really attack it from that end and try and find solutions for the problems from that side, just the way the budget goes, the way the politics have gone. Yeah. Isn't the swing been really, let's go at it from the technological side?
Yeah, it seems to me that way. I would say that the liberals also can fall into that too. And I would say, though, that it appears that way to me. It appears that way to me. And we don't have people like Martin Luther King who, I think, talked about hope in a fuller sense in the real world out there. So it does appear to me right now that productivity is the answer to our problems. We can solve our problems. I mean, you just hear it. There's one pep talk after another. You know? And we can solve them, not only solve them, but solve them without sacrifice. And not only solve them without sacrifice, but we have a right and a calling to solve them without sacrifice. That is, I would say...
For who?
For who? Sacrifice for who?
Yeah.
Well, without sacrifice for us.
Right.
For us. Now, future generations, we don't have to worry so much about them because, of course, technology will grow and be able to help them. The third world, we don't really have to worry about because, you know, as the technology grows, there's kind of a Lazarus economics that the crumbs on the table will get bigger because there'll be more on the table for everyone. Okay? Now, at the same time, the liberals, I think, fell into a problem where they were going to have pump more money in, and that's the way to solve all the problems. Okay? And I think the ability to say we have failed in many areas they didn't, but we have failed, but we still have hope. I would say the liberals, in many cases, didn't understand grace either. Grace allows you to say, yes, this has failed. Let's celebrate the fact that we can have grace in failure and success. In fact, we ought to celebrate our failures. Lutherans ought to more than they do the successes, because that's where grace comes in even more. Okay? And so I think the liberals also. But right now, a lot of the rhetoric, as far as I can see, is
because,
technological.
Right, because the failure that you're talking about that the liberals suffered, what does that mean then to more conservative people?
Yeah.
They just meant that, you know, we've got to get this technological
solution.
Right. Right. Yes, you had someone here.
Just thinking about how can we fit in these people now? It's just so common today. These people that are preparing for the worst by deep ending themselves. Right. They're storing food. They have armaments, and they are going to protect them. Their family, and you know, come the nuclear holocaust, or Armageddon, or whatever they call it. They certainly fit in someplace in this.
Yeah, they look at violence as the, you know, they're getting weapons. They describe grandmothers with machine guns. I mean, you know, and. They look at violence as a way that they're going to solve their problem, period, no matter what happens. And let's put it this way. Let's suppose everything they say comes to happen. And they're the ones left. They're going to have to live with each other.
They can't let
God
and God, that's
for sure. Yeah, they're going to have to live with each other. So the survivalist that puts survival at the highest value, you know, they must have a horrible concept of existence. I mean, it just of who they are. I mean, that they will, you know, living with that the terror is right there, and the only way is to go ahead and hoard things and make weapons to each other and. And they're living on it. At a national level, I mean, it's bad enough. But it's always kind of abstract for the person in their own home.
But doing nationally, this. That's what we're doing too?
Nationally, we're doing that too. And yet, we can't simply have the solution. The simple solution is get rid of weapons systems. Again, we'd be placing our hope on a simple solution because it's more complex than that too. All I can say is we've got to struggle with it as a community, and I think this is where Holden is good, and then we've got to, at the end of the day, celebrate the grace and the hope that we have, not because we have the solutions, but in spite of the fact that we don't. And it's that in spite of-ness that I think the word faith fits in celebration. Yes?
Your story reminded me of one that you told about Buckminster Fuller, except for one very important aspect that you added at the end. The story is that when he was a young man and did not have a job, he was ready to throw himself into some body of water or other and end it all. And he thought to himself, now if there was one reason why I should go on, what should it be? And the reason was that he did not, as an individual, need to check actions with any corporation or committee. In other words, that corresponds to what you said. There was something he could do. And that's where his story ends. There wasn't this kind of smile at the end that indicated hope. And that, I think, is the part that is the most important, the acceptance of an observed gift. Energizes the whole rest of the process.
Yeah. And it's important when having that gift, it's probably better to say, and of course I'll be wrong. I think it's probably better to say that than to say, to not slip back into receiving it as somehow something that you've earned. is when you receive that gift, you know, say, well, of course I'll be wrong. Maybe you won't, but at least it's probably a better assumption to say that, because then you can receive the gift of hope more fully. Okay? You can receive, and then, as you say, you can be open so much more to I think you were saying that, to so much more that can be there. And you can open to possible solutions that are absurd that come as a gift. But the giftness, and that it comes as a gift. That hope comes as a gift, and it's an affirmation of you in the struggle, in the paradoxes that you live in. That needs to be accepted. And I think we'd be better off saying, of course I'll be wrong. Maybe at the end of all our discussions, of course we're all wrong, let's go out and celebrate. How absurd. Okay? But yet,
It's true.
Instead of celebrating our own marvelous wisdom.
That's right. That's right.
All these
and that we can do that, and when we do that, then we can go back and practice, you know, our wisdom. I'm not saying to throw out our technology and the rest of that, but in the end, when we're finally pushed against the wall, which religion does to us, we have to celebrate the absurdity of ourselves and the gift that we have. And I guess that's why, you know, religion is our ultimate concern when we're pushed against the wall. Then we have to say, yes, of course we're wrong. And then we celebrate it. And then when we go out in life, we still work to be right, of course. That's the absurdity. That's the absurdity. And yet it's, you know, I don't know of any other answer. And the fact that I don't know of any other answer is a gift. Because if I did know of another answer, I think that I might not be in touch with a gift of hope. Yes.
Were your students willing to leave that hope on an impersonal kind of a thing?
Well, it was personal, because the smile was shared. It was a very personal kind of thing.
Was that accepted as a gift from your teaching? You talk about a gift.
No. It'll be a gift, small g, maybe from that, you know, that I was able to give to them, but...
And that was satisfactory.
But the smile with a capital G, that was a little more strange and absurd, and it just, when they say it was absurd, they smile all the more. That was the thing. I don't know how they rationalized it. That would be secondary. They could accept that answer. Whereas all the rest of it, I just couldn't happen. And to some, I remember one class, and so it was such a relief. To some of them, such a relief. And I had one student write a letter back. I wish I had brought it. It was that kind of thing that keeps me in teaching, I guess. They had struggled so much to get solutions, they couldn't find any. There was someone, you know, really tremendously in distress.
If they are thinking, and if they are the kind of person that cannot drop things, it would seem that they would need to take that farther then, and to find out from whence that hope springs. And somehow, does that not have to lead to a power, a God, or that's what calls me farther. And to leave that in an impersonal thing is just as frightening as the impersonal problem.
Well, I think it was very personal. Now, whether they came to use the language that we use to describe that or not, I don't know. But again, I think back, I am who I am. God can use whatever language God chooses to use. Now, we've got the language, which is a gift, and it can also be a trap to us if we don't watch out, and so that's a gift that we can accept. Now, how they went from there with that, I really don't know.
So they were people that had been trained in the concrete and in the objective for
very good at it.
Years. Mm-hmm. And yet they were finding at the end of it all that what they were trained for, the things that they thought would solve the problem, wouldn't. So the thing that they had faith in wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. So at that point they turned to something that was abstract.
Well, not, I wouldn't say abstract. That smile was as real as any equation or data, that far more real that I could put on the board. Martin Buber has a section in here that I don't know whether I can find it, that refers back to the experience itself. And I will be doing a thing on Buber later. He says you encounter something that's more real than the sensation of your senses. You don't have any formula for it, but it's more real in the sensation of your senses. And I think that smile, when it grips you, that in that moment, not something that you can encapture in a sentence or paragraph or what have you, that's real. And then people say, yeah, that's who I'm called to be. That might be one way that they would express it, the language, and which is religious language. Now, I think too often, though, what we tend to do, and this would be a whole subject for another session, rather than accepting the call, we try to say, where does that call come from? Okay? And we try to get our rational way of explaining the call. Now that, to me, that's secondary. The primary is to accept that call itself as the reality. And then maybe in a community, when we want to examine that call, then we would try to explain it. But I think we should be aware that that call is real, and kind of an explanation, even a theological explanation, is secondary to the call itself. Okay? I mean, it may be necessary for us in a community in order to share those calls, to develop that. But the reality of that call is important, and I think that means to be sensitive to the paradoxes and the distress and the despair that come out of life, and to try and practice some sort of humility so we don't block out the gifts.
Then what you're kind of saying is that what you feel is as important as what you know.
Oh, yes. Yes. And maybe even, and of course, in the Bible, they didn't separate that, right? I mean, to know was with your whole being. They used, and again, I'm getting out of my area, so anyone who wants to correct me, they used the word know also involved such things as a sexual relationship.
But who teaches that?
Who teaches that? Well, in Holden, I've gotten picked up a little bit of that, but right.
I was thinking more of
rational knowing in our head.
Okay.
They have two different words in Greek, from what I understand. One was in your head, and one was knowing with your whole being. And I think the Hebrews only had one, which was knowing with your whole being. Mm-hmm. So we went from the Hebrew with knowing with your whole being to the Greek, which had two words for knowing. One, know with your head rationally, and two, know with your whole being. Until now, the word know means know with your head. So we've made some jumps. Now, it's not that knowing with your head is wrong.
But it's not the whole picture.
But it can be demonic.
Right.
So yes, feelings are important. And people say, oh, but feelings and emotions, they're... You know, it's so hard to define what they really mean, and that's you're right. But that's one reason why it's important to share them in a community, so you can learn from each other to try and grasp the meaning.
Okay. You can go beyond that. It seems like the whole society takes the feelings, you have to get beyond your feelings before you can do something that will have some kind of a goal or objective that you want to reach. And in everything that I thought right away of that show Star Trek,
uh-huh.
Okay, where they had that Dr. McCoy. He was the emotional fellow,
right.
And he never got things done.
Yeah.
Okay, but Spock, who was the real objective fellow,
yeah,
got things done.
Yeah. So there's a paradox there,
yeah,
between the two of them, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, certainly in our culture, emotions are treated in a kind of internal way.
Hmm.
They're internal. We don't treat them as senses like sight is. Okay. Senses of reality, like love is real as matter, okay, physical matter. We don't do that because the senses that we have, the emotions, are treated somehow as these internal kinds of things, okay? The subjective is the internal. If you want to be objective, then you want to see something and measure something, you see? And that's just another way of kind of making unreal a whole dimension of our existence. Making it unreal, it's internal, it's not really saying something about the world out there. And that is a bias in our age because we are committed to precision and control and order, and emotions don't fit into those very well. Okay? But, you know, what we have to say is that doesn't mean that the world and existence is precise and orderly and all the rest of that stuff, just because that's the way we want to communicate about it. You see that there's the demonic, where we say the whole world must be that way because that's the way we talk about it. Okay? Yes?
Well, do you think that one ought to deal in the feeling and emotions along with the think?
Yes? Yeah, I think, well, this is what I read... I'm a biology teacher, and I read a book once on wolves. Okay, I was really interested in wolves. And I'm from Minnesota, there's wolves there. I had a real interest in wolves, and I read a book on wolves, and I found out how big they are, I found out how much they weigh, I found out their habits, where they live, what they eat, and all that. But then I read another book by a man named Barry Lopez, which told me those same things, but then went beyond and told me how the animal was thought of and dealt with different cultures that had to deal with that animal, the Eskimos and the Indians. And I got a much bigger, rounder picture of what the wolf was by getting a look at their feeling and emotions about that animal.
Yeah.
Beyond the purely scientific, you have to be scientific. You have to have discipline and be objective to find out some information, but you also have to have, I think, or I have to have as a human being, I have to have the feelings and the emotions so I understand the animal in the full sense of the word. So I think science tends to be objective,
right,
wholly because you can't be objective about most feelings.
Let's suppose, let me give an example that might get down to your experience. Suppose you had a very special friendship or relationship, very special, very meaningful in your life, and you wanted to tell me about that. You wanted to give evidence about that so it would become evident to me. How would you do it? How would you do it? Just think about how you would do that. Right? How would you do that? How would you communicate that to me?
The easiest way would be you having had such an experience.
Okay. But still, how would you communicate it to me?
In story form.
Girl. All right, in story form. You'd start telling stories, you see? And you'd be telling the story, oh, I remember one time when my son was sick, or something like that. Now, if I kept, let's say you said, I remember one day my son was sick, okay? Or daughter, or whatever, okay? That's just because I have two sons, so I identify with that, okay? And suppose I said, what day was it? What was the precise diagnosis? How much temperature did he have? And your friend comes in, how much did he weigh? Now, what would you do if I kept doing that? I want precise and objective information. Every time you try to tell your story, suppose I did that, what would you do?
Stop telling the story.
You stop telling the story. All right, now that's how I think a lot of the things in the Bible happen. We try to be objective, precise, and so forth, and they simply stop telling the story. The only way that you're going to be able to tell me about meaningfulness and significance is to tell a story that I get involved in with feeling. And I will not be able to do that if I'm not involved with real people. You see? And then I get involved in your story with feeling. This objectivity means being the detached observer. That won't work. Being precise, that won't work. You know, taking measurements, that won't work. Okay? So we're back into here. That this objectivity and precision, this technological way of doing things, it's not going to work for some things, and one of the things it's not going to work for is the hope, with a capital H. Yes?
Are you aware of what your students' exposure had been to things like music and art along the way in their education?
A little bit. I will say this, I teach a graduate course on sociology of technology, and we have about 10, 12 students, and about half of them foreign students from all over the world. When we talked about technology, no problem. Experience, we could talk, no disagreements. When we talked about art or poetry, the discussion turned into a massive chaos. Generally, art, music is considered in a technological society as a form of entertainment, okay? And I think you can look around. What is entertainment? Something to make you feel good or feel in a particular way, okay? It's that subjective again. It's not considered to be a form of communicated evidence about the reality of the world, okay? In fact, what it's to do is to quite often relieve you from the reality of the world. You escape into entertainment and you feel good so you can go out into the real world. Well, that's a tremendously destructive way to treat the arts. The arts should be considered as a form of, vital form of communicated evidence about the world so that we can grasp at the fullness of our world in a more full way, in a more real way. It's not taught that way. Now, suppose an engineer were to learn that, and suppose they were to go to a modern art show, and they were to say, look at that, it's
flat, it's distorted, has no depth, it has no meaning. Now, if they say that's ridiculous as a form of entertainment, but suppose they were to say, wait a minute, they're trying to tell me something about the world we live in. Punk, it hits them. A whole different message is.
I just had a recall on something that Cahill Gibran, I think, wrote, and I'm not sure if I have it right, but he said to rest in reason and act in emotion.
That might
be. And you know, I think that, for me, fits a little bit in what we're saying, that there is the place for reasoning and problem solving, but to maybe rest in that area, but then when the feeling comes or the hope, that maybe that's the action.
That's one way. I think what you were getting at, maybe we shouldn't separate them so much, though. We ought to treat the whole experience of which rationality is part of it, as well as paradox and emotion and despair and hope, and that's a reality we live with it. And I think that's kind of the message of my story is, I didn't, for some reason, I stuck with the despair that the students had. And then, surprise, surprise, here came some hope. And without the despair, though, wouldn't have gotten to that. Without sticking with it. Okay, we're beginning to do what I would call now the limitations of technology. Limitations of objectivity, preciseness, exactness, without being anti-technology. And when we do that, I think a whole lot of theological questions and concerns become open to us, because I think we're trapped too much in a technological shell, and it just seems that way. No, Bertie.
It's kind of frightening to think that that some of our leaders are kind of attracted to that reason to solve.
Yeah.
Rationalism.
But we all are. I don't want to single out the leaders. Of course, leaders are really followers who are able to get a lot of support. And even Gandhi said, I will lead my people as soon as I can find out which way they're going, or something like that. So they are a reflection on us. Okay, the bell is rung. Time has made its call.